Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs. Now, here's the host of Our House, Peter Hunt.
Good morning and welcome to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. There's literally thousands of real estate websites out there that have all the listings here in Western New York, but there's only one HuntRealEstate.com, and I mention that because if you go to HuntRealEstate.com as opposed to any of the other real estate websites out there, you're not going to get just one algorithm to determine what the value of your home might be, but you're going to have three. So you can get an opportunity to see how different methodologies can arrive at a valuation for your particular property. Of course, no algorithm knows what's inside the house, and this is why obviously real estate agents exist, because they take the volume of data that's out there and help you to interpret it. But there's more data available at HuntRealEstate.com than any other website that serves any of our communities where we do business. This show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. I encourage you to call them today. Hunt Mortgage is the home of the pre-purchase commitment and the low rate and closing cost guarantee. And both of those things probably have never been more important than they are today. Number one, the low rate and closing cost guarantee. Rates are rising, and you want to make sure that you're getting the best deal in town. There's only one way to do that, and that's to call the people at Hunt Mortgage at 633-3700, so call them today. And the pre-purchase commitment allows you to not just be qualified for a loan, which any lender will do, but actually be armed with a mortgage commitment when you go out to buy a home, and there's nothing like it in the market. I believe there's a copycat or two out there, but there's nothing like the pre-purchase commitment. All you need is the property. That's all you need. Everything else is done before you set foot in the first house that you want to look at. Available only at Hunt Mortgage, 633-3700. And don't forget about the first ever 24/7, 365 real estate hotline. That's the Hunt Hotline, which gives you access to information about any property for sale here in Western New York or anywhere across upstate or even out to Phoenix, Arizona. All you have to do is dial 631-4800. When you go to that, all you have to do is know the number of the house that you want to look at, the street number. The hotline will prompt you with a series of street names. Pick the one you want, and then you'll be texted a link to a dedicated website in that particular property, which allows you to get all the information you need without any strings attached and on any property, not just our listings, but any property available, no matter whose sign is in front of that house. 631-4800 will get you all the information you need. Hunt Real Estate is the relocation real estate provider for the Buffalo Bills, the Buffalo Sabres, and the Rochester Americans, our hometown professional teams. We have a very special show for you today. In the studio with me today is Chris Jacobs. Mr. Jacobs is a member of the New York State Senate. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You know, Chris, you have a unique position in our guest history. You've been here in various iterations of your career, and one tends to feed on the other, build on the other. The first time you were on as a developer. And you told us a lot about what you were doing, and I want you to update us on what's going on in that part of your life. Then you joined us as the county clerk, which was a very important role for all of us in the real estate business. And I want you to update us on what's going on there since you left, if you know. But I know how you left it, and I think you left it in great shape. And then, of course, your role as a state senator, which is also very important today. And I want you to be talking a little bit about what you're doing there. But let's start with the state senate for a second here, Chris. If you could do, you know, there's 20 studies out there that show that New York State is, let's say, not as competitive as some other states vis-a-vis its business climate, and its approach to a business that might want to grow or start here in New York State. And there's a few programs that the governor's put in, other governors have put in that tend to mitigate some of the competitive disadvantages of New York State. But they all tend to be short-term or relatively short-term, which means that at some point in time, somebody's going to make a decision. Either the state extends the program or the business decides it may go someplace else. And we've interviewed companies on the show, representative companies on the show that have taken advantage of, for example, Startup New York. But from your seat in the Senate, what do you think is the one or two most important things that could happen in the state Senate, the state legislature, and the governor's office that would improve the competitiveness of the business climate here in New York State?
That's a significant question, and I think it's something we think about a lot up in Albany. I think recently I had a meeting with a number of business owners. The Senate leader was in town, and John Flanagan, and he was in for something, and I said, if you could spare an hour, I'd like to try to set up a meeting with just a few businesses. You know, a lot of times people come into town like him and they meet with the associations, which is fine, but I think sometimes it's really good just to listen to a business owner, small, medium-sized business owner. I think one thing that you hear from them is, boy, it seems like all these incentives are out there for the new guy that comes into town and a new startup or trying to lure that big new business from outside the area and shower them with all these benefits. What about us? What about the guys here and gals here who have been fighting for decades and trying to be competitive here and continue to stay here? And frankly, on just a balance sheet, they probably would make a lot more sense to move out of the area, but because they're committed to the area and the obviously family reasons, but also the people that work for them. You know, what about us? So I've really tried to make sure that we focus more on, you know, growing from within and supporting those that have been loyal to us. And certainly, actually, the small businesses are where the growth happens anyway. I think that if we could, I would rather have 500 businesses all increase two jobs than try to land one business that's creating, you know, a couple hundred jobs and we don't know if they're going to stay. So I think that what I hear from them is certainly the taxes. But I asked one business who was not able to make the meeting with the leader. I said, well, he was talking about a new regulation, but I could talk about that would be very devastating to some businesses here. And he was just this pile-on. It's not one regulation. It's a pile-on of regulations. And New York State has twice as many regulations as any other state in the nation. But I asked him what he said, I operate my business in New York State at, I think it was about a $650,000 cost disadvantage annually to my competitor in another state. So I asked him to articulate, well, what are some of the biggest ones? He said, for me, it's my power because that's what I use. And the state taxes on power. So we pay, you know, even though we're by the most inexpensive power resource in the world.
The most efficient hydroelectric power plant in the world.
Right. And this was a business in Niagara County, in North Tonawanda. So those are the things I really want to focus on, that we have these inherent advantages that due to New York State are disadvantages. So those are the things, workers' comp, huge thing that we need to work on. These are the things that really undermine businesses. And there seems to be a real tin ear up there. You know, it seems to be the governor at this point in time. It's great he does these big new programs. But then on the flip side, not only do we already have, we have over 300,000 regulations in New York State. The average statewide in the nation is 150. But yet these new regulations upon regulations keep on coming. So these are the things that just a death by a thousand cuts type of thing that we just need to become more aware of the damage that does.
And when you talk to the business leaders, do they have any kind of faith that there's a light at the end of this tunnel, or do they just say, you know, I'm here because I like it here, mm-hmm. I'm here because my family's always been here, I'm here because I like Western New York or Central New York or wherever they're from? Or do you find that they just say, you know, there's the point in time here, Chris, where I gotta call it a day and mm-hmm. go someplace that's a little friendlier?
I think the tone with the meeting we had, I thought, was very productive. And these were, I specifically picked people who were manufacturing because I think that I just think that is so important to maintain that base here. And they were not a moan fest. They were articulating specific things that could help them. But, you know, I said, now we're seeing problems, but these folks are still competing. They're still doing well. But the fact is, imagine if we lifted that wet blanket of, you know, regulations and policies that just do not make sense. Imagine what we could do. and with the natural resources we have, with the institutions we have here, our proximity and all these things, we could really be lighting it up. And that's really what I am focused on. Workforce issues are another issue, too, that is an issue they talk about frequently, and something we need to be certainly focused on as we have this kind of gray tsunami of retirement in this area.
That's interesting. I want to come back to that a little bit, because that's that obviously is a source of a concern for any business today. We have an aging population, period, but beyond that, we've got a workforce that's, you know, a large segment of which, and I've thrown around some statistic on the show, are just going to be retiring, aging out, and pretty soon there's going to be voids all over a bunch of businesses here. But, you know, one of the upsides that you, I'm sure, see, or downsides, depending on your perspective, is the impact on philanthropy. When a business leaves this community, or an owner of a business chooses to make his residence in another state to save taxes, the state then goes after them and makes sure that their heart, as they put it, literally, is not in New York, but it's wherever they are now, which may be represented by them giving to the Philharmonic or to a hospital or to a college or something like that here in our community. And that, I think, is one of the most devastating effects of this lack of competitiveness. A business moves. Mm-hmm. And when it moves, it may have its heart still here and want to support the business or the institutions here that they've always loved, but they simply can't, because it would be a little check mark in the
exactly.
column that says you really didn't move.
Exactly. So it drives them, because of the fact, if you move to Florida for tax reasons, or your company, it could be you, individual company, if you did things like give your church that you attended for 50 years, or the Philharmonic, or anything, that's going to be used against you in a court of law to say you are actually still a New York State resident. So it really, the impact is, the ripples are very significant beyond just the business, but it's the community. And so we need to reverse that. We need to focus on those sort of things. So, you know, it seems like the statistic I've heard is that New York State spends more on economic development incentives and grants than any other state, but yet we're ranked at the bottom. Well, why? Because that is just, you know, trying to make up for the broad base policies that we have in this state, which make us non-competitive. And I think we need to really focus more on that. And also, I believe, in terms of economic development funds, we need to have some sort of objective standard to evaluate the effectiveness of programs. A lot of times we'll hear up in Albany an anecdote, oh, this program was great, look at this one business, or you see the ads on television, which is another issue of a waste of money. But we need an objective standard to know if there's a return on investment, because I think you could make an argument that some of those funds are not well spent, should go to just try to decrease the environment of taxes on a broad scale.
You know, there have been some studies done, and they don't show these programs mm-hmm. to be all that great mm-hmm. in terms of their net impact. I spent this past week in Arizona, and I watch the financial shows in the morning, mm-hmm. and those financial shows are covered with ads about the new York.
Oh, is that right?
Covered in Arizona. I mean, it's one of the most frequently appearing ads as I flip from one channel to another. So it has to cost a fortune.
Yeah, I think I saw in our budget, it's a $20 to $30 million a year. I mean,
I heard
significant.
52 or
okay.
Or,
so yes, I don't know exactly, but it was real money. And there is, we're actually the state Republican, Senate Republicans in our budget. That's a specific thing we're pushing on cutting out in our budget, because we just don't feel there's enough accountability on it.
Mm-hmm. So there's no, obviously there's got to be some kind of lead flow mechanism from those ads. And do you ever see that kind of data?
Lead flow as far as how much you get? Yeah, well, it's anecdotal. Oh, well, you know, tourism has increased. I'll tell you an example. There's been this issue about the governor putting these signs on the thruway,
right, exactly.
which he was told over and over again they're violating their federal law because of the federal aid that gets on the thruway. Did it anyway all throughout, and now he's going to have to take them down. But I'd heard people say, well, you know, since those signs went up, tourism has increased. Well, I mean, how's that correlation? You know, so
they're already in the state.
Right. But Yeah, right, exactly. So this is the type of stuff that just doesn't help us in making good decisions. So I think I put forth legislation that every single economic development program, there has to be a companion independent analysis on every 3 years. You know, so everything's on the same standard, not that Empire State Development does an analysis of their own program, which, you know, you can't argue that's very objective.
All right. And did that law pass?
Oh, no, not yet. We're still fighting.
We're working on it. Okay, good. One of the arguments that we hear frequently here, which is probably equally anecdotal, is that the real problem is the attitude from downstate. Things appear to be going well there in terms of the net effect of business and the generation of tax dollars and their flow into Albany, for example. Some of the attitudinal issues center around the fact, well, we're doing okay. Upstate, well, you know, upstate's upstate, but the real engine is New York. Mm-hmm. To what extent is that New York City-centric attitude real, number one, as far as Albany goes, where you sit? And to what extent is it really diminishing the impact of the kind of changes you're talking about emanating from upstate in terms of making the kind of changes that we might need here to make upstate continue to be viable?
I think that I was aware and talked about when I ran the dominance of downstate in New York City. Since I've been up there, it's become much more apparent to me. It's just the amount of, you know, the population is so significant there, which then in turn the representation in Albany is so significant that, frankly, but for the Senate majority, we're the only body that has upstate leadership and can push back a little bit. But I'll say, you know, New York City is a awesome economic engine and provides a significant amount of our tax revenue. I want New York City to succeed, and it's really in a great place right now, always has its challenges. What I want to say is I'm not going to fight New York City. I want to help them succeed. But let's understand that New York City is as different as from the rest of the state as Mars. So why don't we just say policies done in New York City are for New York City, and let's talk about looking at we not a broad-based policy that because of the fact of how different the rest of the area is. And one bright spot on when we had the minimum wage, which was before I came into office, but that was one of the first times that they recognized that the difference and that the time frame of ramping up to that $15 minimum wage was much quicker in New York City than the rest of the state, understanding it's just a different place. I think that I think we need to look at that more because of the fact that New York City is so resilient. They can do a lot of things to their economy and not hurt it, regulation-wise, tax-wise, where we're, you know, energy will be one. You know, if you live in a 500-square-foot apartment in New York City and you have a little energy tax on that, that doesn't impact you. But if you have a manufacturing company here that the majority of your input is energy, you can undermine a business completely. So we need to really focus on that more.
This issue of policy bifurcation, in other words, where there's a different set of standards for New York City on any given legislation than upstate. Years ago, when one of our previous governors was in office and was here in Buffalo and was talking to a bunch of us about his policies and what was going to happen, this very topic was brought up, and he assured us all that any law could be written in such a way where there was a different set of financial standards for upstate than downstate, which gave me some kind of hope. And you cite the minimum wage law as one of those laws, which obviously is the case. Before we go to the break, and I don't want to pile on about this state issues, but I want to kind of end this segment with your idea of what the light at the end of the tunnel is, and what you and your colleagues in the Senate and the legislature, what you're working on now that's going to hopefully improve everything for the business climate, and by virtue of that, everybody else in the state?
Well, I think last year we had one significant win that we were happy about is workers' comp reform. I think that's something that we really fought hard for the Senate Republican Conference. And I think that's starting to bear some fruit. I would actually like to go back at that and do kind of a reform version two. The issue that we talked about on energy, we're trying to remove, in our budget, we will be proposing removing that energy tax. I think it's called 18A. So trying to just nip away at these elements that make us, compared to other states, it's much more challenging to be competitive. The other issue just I'm working on is I'm chair of a commission on regulations, trying to focus on bringing some more common sense to regulations because, again, as I hear from businesses, when I ask them what regulation really burns you, the answer is it's not one particular one, but it's the mass of them. And try to rationalize the regulations, remove some duplication where you have a federal form that you have to do and the state form is exactly the same. Can't you just merge that, for God's sake? So those sort of things, not necessarily as exciting as a big ribbon cutting, but I think those are the things that we have to focus on for the businesses that we have here to thrive and grow and kind of continue to be competitive in the century.
And last question before we go to the break. Has Startup New York worked?
Again, it's a hard one to evaluate because we don't have an objective analysis. What I've heard anecdotally is not successful, at least around the state, on a statewide effort for the amount of money. I would say it has not borne the fruit that they claimed it would be.
And as you, I'm assuming, or I'm hoping anyway, that in this process of developing some kind of measurement system that is objective for all these things, we can look at other programs, for example, even the Buffalo Billion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that there was a certain target of jobs and other things that were to be created by that program, and a lot of us are wondering whether or not that's happened. And on that very unpleasant note, we'll be right back with more from Arl Steers and Chris Jacobs after these important messages.
If you're a homeowner age 62 or older, you owe it to yourself to look into a reverse mortgage. Reverse mortgages give seniors many different options to access the equity in their home. There's even a reverse mortgage for purchase available. For more information, call Karen Johnson, a reverse mortgage specialist at Hunt Mortgage at 633-3700 or visit huntmortgage.com. Karen Johnson, NMLS number 485939. Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the all-new huntrealestate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. And the show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. Hunt Mortgage is the home of the low rate and low closing cost guarantee and the pre-purchase commitment, among other unique programs. Call them today, 633-3700, to find out about the very best in mortgage financing possibilities for you. And the wonderful thing about Hunt Mortgage, among other things, is the fact that we effectively have a kind of a widespread look at the mortgage market in terms of various investors. So that's how we can provide the lowest rate and lowest closing costs. But the fact of life is there's thousands of mortgage products out there. And to understand what's going on, if you go to one lender only, you're going to get their products. A mortgage company like Hunt Mortgage gives you access to the mortgage products across a multitude of lenders, which gives you a more objective look at the mortgage market. At 633-3700, talk to one of our mortgage consultants today. We have a very special show for you today. In the studio with me today is Chris Jacobs, member of the New York State Senate. And we've been talking, we spent the first segment of the program talking about issues at the state level and what Chris is up to, and just to kind of summarize that, there are three things that you mentioned before the break, Chris, that one was a win on workers' comp and your thoughts about revisiting that even to see what else could be done. Secondly, removing the energy tax, I guess that's probably a staged process, but mm-hmm. Certainly would make our manufacturing companies more competitive. But most interesting was this Commission on Regulations. When did that start?
Been around for a long time. It's called Administrative Rules and Regulations Commission, and I'm the Senate chair of that. So we're hoping to get into our one House budget. The governor's proposed his budget, and then the two legislative bodies will put forth theirs, and then the negotiations begin. But we're going to be hopefully putting a real package of regulation reform into that, because as you see at the federal level, you know, a lot of people talk about how the new tax law has spurred the economy, but I think that also equally to that has been some of the regulation, removal regulations at the federal level have spurred the economy. So they can be have a catalytic effect as much as tax reform. So I'm excited about some of the regulation reform we're doing. And also some of the regulations that have been used by this executive probably more than others, but previous ones as well, and this is more of a good government kind of reform. There's a provision for emergency regulations. Typically when you put a regulation forth, there's a period of comment that the public gets to weigh in and say whether they think it's good or bad, or if it would be, if you tweak it a little bit, it would be more effective or less harmful. But there's this emergency regulation provision you can use and avoid and bypass that comment period. Well, in the last number of years, this administration has, I think there's about 2,000 rules or regulations that have been passed in the last decade.
2,000?
And 60% have been pushed through at emergency regulations. So it's really being abused, and so we're trying to tighten that to make sure that it's used for the real purpose of an emergency, a catastrophic weather event or something like that, but not because you just want to avoid public comment. And I can tell you, public comment can be effective. We have a regulation right now that is being proposed by the Department of Labor that I held a hearing on. It's called predictive scheduling. And this would require all employers, no matter big or small, if you don't schedule someone out for 14 days, that you have to. Well, as an example, what it would do is would say something like, "We had Elber's Landscaping can't come and testify." This new regulation would say, if you're on call and don't get called into work, you have to get paid 4 hours. So Jim Horning from Elbers used an example of, let's say there was a storm alert yesterday, and so all his 80 drivers, he said, "Guys, we got to be ready for tomorrow." The storm doesn't come. He has to pay every one of those drivers 4 hours of work for not working. He said, I would just shut down. I'd get out of the business. And this was very close to getting passed. We had a hearing on it. Seems like DOL is now backing off, maybe looking at amending that. But that's the value of a public hearing, because at least it gives an opportunity. They can ignore it and still ram it through, but at least there's an opportunity, and that's what we want to see more of, not an emergency reg to get away with it.
Chris, you know, this radio station is getting into the high-tech world, and listeners can actually text in, and we've got a stream of texts that have come in, and I'm not going to read some of them, but because a lot of them are tongue-in-cheek. Mm. For example, let's increase the cost of electricity in New York so the power authority can then give the government more of our money. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should import more illegals and give them welfare and state aid to help cut costs. I mean, what this reflects, and New York State should have a sign on its board saying "Welcome to New York," and I won't read the rest of it. But the fact of life is that these all reflect a cynicism that people have out there, which is, in my mind, the most discouraging thing. Because, and that's why I asked you about light at the end of the tunnel before the break. And I know there is light, but we need people like you that are there. Vocalizing the other side of these kinds of comments, which would be, what could we do for you, as opposed to just the cynical side, mm-hmm. which, because they're going to say, look, I give up. A lot of people are simply giving up.
I think that's absolutely, and that would go to some of the need. We have an obligation, as an elected person that's new to the state government, to work hard to earn their trust in us and belief that things we can do things. And then I think the cynicism And I see it certainly when I've run, the apathy. I don't vote. It doesn't really matter. That they just don't feel that the state government is there for them, really listens to them. So why bother? Why waste my time going to vote? And I've tried to focus on some reforms that would maybe earn back their trust. I'm a huge proponent of term limits. I believe that we have too many people that go into government and stay far too long and become focused more on perpetuating their own existence up there and the special interests that will keep them there versus the people that elected them. I think you should go up for a period of time, serve, and then come back, live under the laws that you passed, and be a citizen again. And I think we have, if you look at the 20-plus people who have been either convicted or indicted over the last number of years, one common strand of those is that they were in government for a long, long, long time. So that's something I think that resonates with folks. I'm still pushing hard on that. Another reform I was happy that we did get we passed last year and was on the ballot this November, where it would strip pensions away from politicians convicted of corruption. Believe it or not, Shelley Silver, if he is convicted, he will keep his pension. That is this thing I think people are saying, you know, not only did he steal all this money, they are also going to get a lifetime pension tax-free. We did succeed in that, so I will continue
that
to focus on
that. Did pass.
It did pass, yes,
that's
overwhelmingly.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. And we have a caller on the line, Chris. This is John from Rochester. John, how can we help you? Good morning, John.
Hey, Pete.
How are you?
Chris, minimum wage. It really kicks me off that Governor Cuomo unilaterally instituted minimum wage increases on all state employees. And that really bothers me as a taxpayer. And I think the legislature should be outraged about that. And connected to that is the right-to-work legislation that other states have passed, Michigan, Indiana, in recent years. And I'll tell you, I think that would be a boost to the economics of New York. And the third point I want to make is I'm outraged at the lawlessness of the sanctuary cities that we have in New York State. And to me, that represents lawlessness. What can you do about it as a state senator?
Interesting.
The first question, you know, it's interesting you talk about the minimum wage. I was at a meeting yesterday. The town of Tonawanda, which I represent every year, has a meeting with their representative from the Senate, myself, and Assemblyman Schiminger, just to kind of go department by department on what they're doing and what their needs are. And the gentleman who runs the recreation department, probably a little broader name on what the scope is, but said the minimum wage, they run the pools, and you know, they hire a lot of young people for summer jobs, which a lot of us worked when we were younger. Just by the minimum wage increase, their budget expense is going to be $150,000 next year just by trying to bump up. So that's a cost. they're going to have. There's no assistance from the state. That's an example of an unfunded mandate. They're going to either have to take it out of, you know, raising taxes on their taxpayers. So, and I think that when the advocates are, advocated for the minimum wage, they would use the example of a working adult trying to make ends meet on a minimum wage. The fact of the matter is about 90% of the people who work minimum wage are part-time employees in school. And so the example of what you see of young people working at the rec department. So there's a lot of unintended consequences that happen when you pass policies that are not thought through. I'm a big advocate of if you're talking about trying to help somebody that's a full-time worker and an adult with a family, there's a program the federal government has, the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a tax credit which helps those that are full-time people working at low-paid jobs that are minimum wage or just below, just above. But I think that the minimum wage is, you had mentioned the issue of the governor passing that without legislative approval. And that's an example of when we talk about regulations. This is using an old law that was designed for a specific purpose and really abusing it and saying out of this, regulation, I'm gonna use this and keep broadening what I can do with it. And what he did was he passed a minimum wage without ever having to get legislative approval. Now, that was the fast food minimum wage that he did. Subsequently, he came back to the legislature, I think because enough of people made noise about it, and passed a minimum wage more broadly. The problem is we have a situation now where fast food is on a different trajectory or time frame of going up to that $15 minimum wage, and others are not. You can have a situation where a convenience store can have the convenience clerk being on the schedule that was passed by the legislature, but if there's a Subway in that store, that person is got to be paying more. So people at McDonald's are on a different track than the rest of us. It really disrupts the marketplace, and it's just not the way. Minimum wage increases is a significant decision. It should be made by the legislative body, not rammed through by the executive. And it really has had some unintended harmful effects to local governments, to nonprofits working with people with disabilities, and all these effects. Those are the things that really needed to be talked about, and they're much more deliberated when you go through a legislative process.
And we'll be back with more from Our House to Yours after these very important messages.
If you're a homeowner age 62 or older, you owe it to yourself to look into a reverse mortgage. Reverse mortgages give seniors many different options to access the equity in their home. There's even a reverse mortgage for purchase available. For more information, call Karen Johnson, a reverse mortgage specialist at Hunt Mortgage at 633-3700 or visit huntmortgage.com. Karen Johnson, NMLS number 485939. Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and homeownership experience. And also the show is brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, home of the low rate and closing cost guarantee, and also the pre-purchase commitment. That's 633-3700. One of our mortgage consultants waiting for your call right now. We have a very special show for you today. We're attacking what I think is probably among the most important issues that businesses and homeowners, frankly, face here, because embedded in all that we're talking about here is the fact that taxes in any form decrease the value of real estate. That's just, there's a formula, and we've talked about it here on the show many times. But if you're competing, there's only so much that any family can afford to pay. And if more of that affordability amount is taken by taxes, it's less than that can go to principal and interest, and as a result, property values will be suppressed in this. And you know, New York City defies that. We were talking about that earlier, Chris. New York City defies that. But having said that, why does it defy that? And a lot of it is because, number one, the units are generally smaller, and number two, there's a lot of foreign investment.
Exactly, yeah.
Lots of foreign investment, which we don't have anywhere else in the state, really. And I am in the studio today with Chris Jacobs, a member of the New York State Senate. We've been talking about issues relative to the state. But before we go too much farther, I wanted to mention one thing to our listeners, and that is that last week I called into the show from out of town to just to express my sympathies to one of our more prominent families here in Western New York, the Joya family, with the sudden passing of their youngest brother, Freddie. And just this week, again, we lost another great member of our community, Marcy Dandis, who passed away suddenly just the other day. And it's John Dandy's wife from the Buffalo Bisons, and it's a real shame. She was with our company for over 20 years. just a wonderful person, and just a tragedy, really, that that family is suffering, and our sympathies go out to them. And I hate to start this segment on a negative note, but I think it's important that people know that what's going on in our community when we know those the kinds of things. But Chris, we were talking about a couple things that came up from the last questionnaire about, for example, right-to-work legislation. When that was passed in Michigan, it was shocking to me because Michigan is obviously a heavy manufacturing state, the home of American automobile industry. and very, very pro-union, generally speaking, in terms of the workforce there. How could something like that happen in a state like Michigan? And really, there's no prayer of it happening in this state. Wouldn't you agree?
I think that's very unlikely. I think the bright spot I see on the private sector laborers is that they have really had to compete. And for instance, my district actually has the GM plant on River Road, and I toured that recently, and they're thriving. I toured actually the Sumitomo plant, the former Dunlop plant, that mm-hmm. is thriving, making nearly $100 million investment to grow that company there.
And are they getting state incentives for this to happen?
I think Sumitomo's. I'm sure they're getting some, but I think that the two reasons that good workforce that they have that does a great job there, affordable electricity because they do get cheap power from the power plant, and water.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working very hard with the supervisor in that because there's an issue with their access to raw water because of the closure of the Huntley power plant. But, you know, that and actually I have Ford also in my district. So there is success stories, and I think private labor, private unions have understood it's a new world, and they have to be competitive. They have to train to get skills, and they have to deliver. And I think they're doing that. So I think that that's what we'll see more here. And they have to adjust to the marketplace. And when you're competing with now Michigan, you're going to have to do some adjustment in that regard.
We do have an incredible infrastructure here.
Absolutely.
And so it's hard to place a value on that. At the same time, other states I know compete for business against us mm-hmm. with our own businesses here and promise and often have an infrastructure in place that they can also leverage to attract someone from our community. But you do mention one thing that's very important, and I just want to come back and you touched on it earlier, and that's the whole issue of workforce development. It's generally perceived that we have a good workforce here, a high-quality workforce, skilled workforce. I think the margin between us and other communities may not be as great as we think it mm-hmm. is sometimes, but the fact of life is that, as we also talked about, a lot of those people are aging out or retiring for one reason or other. And it's a real challenge. I know many people, many groups in this town are going at this, everything from the university to the partnership, and I know even in the Senate you're addressing this. Mm-hmm. What do you see from your perspective that needs to be done to create more focus on this issue?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I've heard numbers on the private side of 50,000 over the next less than a decade. I was just at a meeting at DeUville. They're proposing a new facility in regards to healthcare, the healthcare sector. Same issue, about 50,000 jobs in the next decade in that area. So almost every sector is going to experience this, and the need for training individuals who are in school right now to look into the vocations that they, you know, making them understand that this is a career that could arguably pay better than a white-collar career oftentimes, and also the ability to understand that the day of someone being in one place, one job for their entire career may not be the norm anymore. And even if it is, the need to retrain and skill up again and again and again. And that's very important also in the role of kind of our community colleges in playing that role. And the need for our community colleges to be able to adapt and be more nimble to when there's a need to be able to address that need. And so I think there's a lot of groups doing good things. The Northland Corridor project that's coming online. The Buffalo Niagara Partnership has a great initiative. I always have a concern about the multitude of entities that are doing that and hoping that they're coordinating and maximizing the immense amount of resources that are devoted to this. And I think that's something we need to continue to work on. And also making sure they're always staying in tune, you know, because a lot of these are university, public sector, you know, making sure that they are tightly connected to the marketplace so they're not training something for a job that won't exist in a year or two, which can be the case nowadays as quickly as things are happening.
There's no question about that. You mentioned a few things: vocational training, trades, training for the trades themselves, and retraining for today's industries, which is, like you say, an immense challenge, because how do you anticipate? You know, 5 years, 10 years out.
Yeah, because right now we see an instance where our unemployment rate was ticking up a little bit, even though our jobs were going up. And what was happening is they were tapping out on the skills. There were the individuals that were unemployed did not have the skills. So it really is part of this, and it can get to the point where a business cannot pursue more contracts because they just can't get the workforce.
Exactly right. I want to read one comment that came in a few minutes ago. I really like what this guy has to say. Who is this that is speaking?
Peter Hunt.
He must be referring to Chris Jacobs, that's for sure. I really like what he has to say, too. And one other comment is, please explain the legality of my state, apparently his own, my state workers' pension being tax-free. Isn't that discriminatory? In other words, if I'm a state employee and I get a pension, mine is tax-free, but if it's private, it's taxable.
It's a valid question. I know that we are looking to try to exempt I think one issue we're going to be focusing a lot this session is in the Republicans on affordability, especially for those seniors being able to stay in their homes and so forth. And one thing we're proposing is trying to exempt more of a private pension for that issue. But I think that's a legitimate question. I think that also there's a lot of people who get frustrated. Okay, you're a public employee, you get that tax-free pension, even when you move out of the state.
Right.
Maybe we should talk about that.
What's interesting, I obviously speak to a lot of people buying and selling homes, and I remember one time I spoke to a couple, and they were both teachers, and they were talking about selling their home because they were retiring, and I said, well, when do you retire? He knew down to, I think, the minute.
Absolutely.
And I said, what will you do then? He goes, well, we're moving to Arizona. And I started thinking to myself, just as you mentioned, well, all the money that they've earned here and paid into the system now, presumably, I think, when we thought about these things, we expected people to stay in the state and spend that money here.
Absolutely.
And now it's being spent someplace else where business climate might be a little bit,
right.
And it's frustrating. I know it is to you to hear that kind of thing. We have a bunch of callers. We're just going to take one call. This is Jay from Buffalo. Jay, how can we help you?
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question.
Very quickly, Jay. We only got a minute or so.
Early in the conversation, you talked about measuring economic development to see if it was successful, and then just now you mentioned this Northland project and employment training or skill training, whatever you want to call it. How are you going to measure, what is going to be your data for measuring the success of these programs? You're starting up a whole new, I want to say, service industry here with the state.
Interesting.
Thank you.
Good question. And I think that certainly not my project, but I would say that I don't have a specific answer to that, but I think along the same lines, we need to have some level of objective analysis on outcomes of every workforce training program, just as we do for any economic development program, so we can assess which ones are working, and if they're not, no more state money, and go elsewhere, spend them elsewhere.
Chris Jacobs, I wish we had another hour.
Well, thank you.
We're just getting started, and I'm going to invite you back again.
Absolutely, love to.
Because it's in my mind, this is among the most important things we can be talking about relative to the value of real estate. Our mission here on this show is to help our listeners protect and enhance their investment in real estate, and we want that to continue. I know you're an investor, and I've got an investment in real estate here, as many of our listeners do. We want to make that as good as we can, and that a lot of that comes from Albany. Chris Jacobs, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank our listeners. We'll be back again next week. And remember, when it comes to real estate, Western New York and all of upstate is Hunt Country.